Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, a radical rethink about asthma treatment and who should get what. Painkillers to prevent cancer, which one is best? Painkillers to treat pain, which is the least useless? And the Australian Institute for Health and Welfare, or of Health and Welfare, has released the latest statistics on cancer in Australia. Breast cancer is still at the top, bowel cancer next, followed by prostate and melanoma. And counterintuitively, while cancer incidence is rising, when you do have cancer, you're less likely to die from it. And hidden in this are some important messages for us all, with no cause for complacency. Here to talk about them and also follow up on a story we had on last week's Health Report on breast density and the risk of breast cancer is the Chief Executive of the Cancer Council Australia, Sanchia Aranda. Welcome to the Health Report, Sanchia.
Hi, Norman. How are you?
All right. Let's start with breast density, which can increase the risk of breast cancer by 400%, may explain about one in three breast cancers in premenopausal women. Now, last week we had research on which talked about this and showed it might be related to inflammation. But what we discovered as part of that is that the only state in Australia to actually tell women they have dense breasts and be aware of this problem is breast screen in Western Australia. And the national policy of breast screen Australia is actually not to even record whether a woman has breast density, high breast density. What's going on, Sanchia?
Part of the challenge for the breast screen program is that breast density is actually on a continuum. It includes bright and areas within the breast and white areas. It looks as if the white area relates to the masking of diagnosis, so that increases the risk that the women that a woman's breast cancer would not be detected with mammographic screening, whereas the bright area is the it looks like it's the indicator of increased risk. And so part of getting cancer, so part of the challenge for the breast screen program is we currently don't have the algorithms to actually make those distinctions, and we don't have the capability of then knowing what it is that you're telling a woman. So just telling someone they've got dense breasts is not very helpful. There's no guidance for what you would then do in terms of management, and we desperately need the research that will back up the kinds of information we have about density now.
So you're in a state of ignorance. You mean, in other words, if you say what you're arguing, what you're saying is that if a woman's got dense breasts, you don't know what to recommend. You should have ultrasound, you should have MRI, you should have more frequent examinations, so we just won't do anything.
Well, there's a lot of things that are actually happening. John Hopper in Victoria has done some fantastic work looking at how you use digital mammography to be able to separate out the very bright areas that look as if they're associated with the increased risk of getting cancer. There are other groups that are looking at how you collaborate really to understand what you should do for diagnosis. And part of the challenge for us in Australia is that the breast screen program has to be about, it's a one-size-fits-all approach, and this is going to take much more tailored advice to women. We know that this very bright area of breast density is probably more important for this very small subset of women than even something like a BRCA1 mutation. So we want to be able to develop risk algorithms that can be applied to individual women. The embedding of that within the breast screen program will be very complicated because it is a population-based program. And so we would like to see researchers come together and embed the work in the breast screen program and for funders to actually see that as a priority.
Well, it is a priority, isn't it? I mean, you compare it to the gene that causes like 10 times the risk of breast cancer, but breast density can increase the risk 6 times. So it's not that far off the breast gene.
So this varies because you think about breast density on a continuum. It's the very one end of it, which is this increased areas of brightness. So it's not a huge volume of women. So it's very similar that breast screen, because it's one size fits all, doesn't lend itself to doing this at a population level. We're going to have to look at how you do risk stratification and model that. And of course, from a government perspective, you can imagine the anxiety that if you have a different screening interval, say for very low risk women versus very high risk women, and one of those women gets an interval cancer, if you haven't done the work appropriately, then you can cause more problems than you thought you were going to fix.
Just before we get onto the cancer statistics, I mean, isn't it a bit patronising to women thinking that they're better off without this information?
I certainly wouldn't advocate for that. So the problem is we're not at the moment understanding what information we should be given. So when when the radiologist is now in WA, they're giving back density information, but there's no indication on that whether this is largely the white areas or the bright areas. So there's no training of radiologists in how to do that at a broader measurement. They use a thing called cumulus, but in fact that's just a broad measure of breast density. And we don't actually know in WA what people are doing with that. And there's research going on there at the moment looking at what are the women making of this information and what are their GPs making of it, because it's coming as static information, not with support for how they would then advise that woman about what's the best approach to manage their breast cancer risk.
Let's move on to cancer stats, which came out just before the weekend. Saturday was World Cancer Day. What are the main messages here from this?
So from a Cancer Council perspective, 3 out of the 5 top cancers in women and 4 of the top 5 in men are preventable cancers, or cancers that can be diagnosed early in the case of bowel cancer. And so this reinforces the need for us to, as a community, to take charge of our health, stop smoking, eat an appropriate diet, limit our alcohol intake, but also importantly to participate in the national screening programs. 36% of Australians participate in the bowel screening program. It's one of our top 5 cancers in both sexes. It's also one of the top causes of death. We know that 78% of people rescreen if they get involved in the program in the beginning. So a public awareness campaign around the importance of bowel screening is urgently needed.
Why is it so low?
It's probably 2 factors. One is that when you get that kit in the mail, there's a yuck factor in it. But also what the community tell us, and some work that's been undertaken in New South Wales, is they don't understand really the importance of bowel cancer in our community. They hear lots about prostate cancer, they hear lots about breast cancer, lots about ovarian cancer, and many people minimise or have minimal understanding of the risks that they have for bowel cancer.
So they don't realise how horrible a rectal cancer can be.
Absolutely not.
And there was some evidence from some federal government research that GPs are not necessarily giving the right advice. They don't necessarily believe that the test is worthwhile.
Certainly from a GP perspective, we know that a number of GPs really say to people, you're much better off to have a colonoscopy, and yet the immunohistochemical test that's used in the bowel screen program is incredibly sensitive. And a very accurately able to pick up the kind of early bleeding from polyps. And so it is about a preventive strategy. We've already got a lot of problems with colonoscopy wait times and other things in this country. So participating in the bowel screening program is still the best thing to do.
And yet here's this cancer report, and there's nothing on treatment. There's nothing on the variations in care. And you and I both know that your cancer outcome, when you've got cancer, is highly dependent on which surgeon or cancer specialist you're sent to, and more importantly, which team. And we know almost nothing about what's happening in the private sector, and yet a lot of all this happens in the private sector. I mean, isn't this something we should be getting pretty angry about?
It's certainly big on our advocacy agenda for the coming period from Cancer Council. We must start collecting stage, treatment and recurrence if we are going to really understand who's missing out in this country. Some work that's been done on New South Wales data shows that the gap between the haves and the have-nots in terms of cancer outcomes is widening. We can't understand that until we can understand variations in treatment and care. So this kind of routinely collected data must be embedded in our system. We have to be able to share data across states and federal jurisdictions. And while there's been positive movement from the Australian government in that regard, we aren't getting enough of that data actually being analysed and informing how we deliver services.
Sanjaya, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Norman. Thank you.
Sanjaya Randaz, Chief Executive of Cancer Council Australia. And you're listening to The Health Report here on RN, ABC News Radio and CBC Radio across Canada. Staying with cancer prevention, it's known that some drugs may reduce the risk of certain cancers. It's called chemoprevention, and the evidence is strongest in bowel or colorectal cancer. A research group at the University of California, San Diego, has brought all the available studies together to see which medication might be best. Siddharth Singh is in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of California, San Diego.
The most commonly studied medication has been aspirin. The other medications that have been looked at are calcium, vitamin D, folic acid, the non-steroidal medications like celecoxib. And all of these medications have been used in combinations too.
And we should just talk about the people that you're trying to treat here. Because it's not just people off the street. It's people who've already got polyps or had cancer.
Correct. We wanted to target a relatively higher risk population, a subset of people who have previously had polyps or colorectal cancer and are at higher risk for recurrence of those polyps or development of cancer.
There hasn't been any what's called head-to-head trials where they've compared these drugs to each other. You had to then go and make some inferences from studies that had already been done of these drugs individually.
Correct.
So when you brought together the international evidence from the most the available trials, and I think that when you added it all up, it was about 12,000 people, what did you find?
We found that the non-steroidal medications such as celecoxib seem to perform really well and decrease the risk of high-risk polyps by about 63% over the next 3 to 5 years. However, from a safety standpoint, these medications were also associated with a high risk of serious events like hospitalization, bleeding risk. So perhaps not applicable to every patient who is at risk for recurrence of polyps, but may be considered for the highest risk patients. So it needs to be a more nuanced decision of risk and benefit. Contrast what we found that low-dose aspirin is fairly effective in decreasing the risk of serious polyps, but at the same time is also a very safe option.
And what about the others, folic acid, vitamin D, and so on? Did they have any effect on preventing?
There was not much that stood out in terms of folic acid by itself or combining it with other strategies. And the same thing for vitamin D. There was some suggestion that calcium may decrease the risk of all types of polyps, not necessarily the high-risk polyps. But there were also some safety signals, which was a little surprising, with calcium. So overall, we did not think that calcium would be a good strategy for prevention of high-risk polyps.
So did you find what the people who've been looking at calcium for osteoporosis have found, which is a higher risk of heart attack?
Yes.
Now, let's just come back to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So you talk about celecoxib, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago in the Health Report, trade name Celebrex. That's one kind of non-steroidal, but the more common ones and the cheaper ones that you can get over the counter are things like ibuprofen or naproxen, naproxen. Were they just as effective as the newer forms of anti-inflammatories in preventing colon cancer?
That's a good question. The trials that were included have basically studied celecoxib and another type of non-steroidal called Celindac. They haven't necessarily studied the non-specific, what we call the COX-1 and the COX-2 inhibitors, which is ibuprofen and naproxen. I suspect the beneficial effects are going to be similar, but the safety profile from a bleeding risk standpoint may be higher with the non-selective.
So bottom line is that if you've got polyps or you've had bowel cancer and you want to prevent a recurrence or the polyp progressing to cancer, then low-dose aspirin is your safest option. That's like 75 or 100 milligrams a day. What about the person who they may have a bit of a family history of colon cancer, a bowel cancer, and they're thinking, well, why don't I just take low-dose aspirin every day for cancer? A lot of doctors do that. What's your view on that?
Sure. So there's a lot of accumulating data on aspirin having a chemopreventive effect, not just against colorectal cancer, but other cancers too.
So, Dr. Singh, are you taking low-dose aspirin?
I haven't started yet. Still in my 30s, but as soon as I asked my dad to start taking it. I would also emphasize that colonoscopy for continued surveillance is important. I mean, this strategy does not necessarily replace that part, but it's probably in combination. In the sense, somebody who's had high-risk polyps shouldn't just rely on aspirin for prevention, but should also continue on colonoscopy-based surveillance.
Siddharth Singh is in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of California, San Diego. And if you're confused about this colonoscopy story, this is when you've had cancer or polyps and colonoscopies for follow-up. Over the last couple of years, we've followed research at the George Institute in Sydney about the effectiveness of common painkillers in back pain. Paracetamol bombed out, as pretty much did codeine. Now they've looked at these same non-steroidal anti-inflammatories that Dr. Singh was just talking about in relation to cancer prevention. So what did they find? Were they much chop in back pain? Here to tell us is Associate Professor Manuela Ferreira. Welcome to the Health Report.
Thank you.
What did you do in this study?
So in the study, we actually reviewed about 35 trials conducted all over the world and including over 6,000 patients with spinal pain. And we're interested in actually assessing or identifying the magnitude of the benefit as well as the risk of adverse events associated with these drugs.
And when you say spinal pain, just describe what was happening to these people on average.
So basically the common back pain as well as neck pain and sciatica.
That's where the pain goes down your leg.
That's right. That's when the pain goes down your leg.
And these were randomized trials, so they were against placebo.
So all of these trials were randomized trials, and so one group received the drug, the anti-inflammatory, and the other group received the placebo or a sugar pill.
So what did you find?
So what we found was actually there is some benefit. So anti-inflammatories, they do offer some benefit compared to placebo, but it's a small benefit. So on average, it's less than 10% what you would get if you just took a sugar pill. And we also found that...
So 10% above a sugar pill.
Above a sugar pill, exactly.
Right.
Less than 10%.
So would you notice it if you didn't know what you were taking? Would you notice that 10% difference?
It's a good question. Arguably, patients wouldn't really think that this is noticeable or worthwhile.
Okay, what sort of percentage uplift would you need to notice it's worthwhile? Because you've done some studies on this.
We have, yeah, exactly. So patients believe that they need to be at least 25% better or above placebo to consider the risks of side effects associated with anti-inflammatories worthwhile.
So, and there are risks of gastrointestinal hemorrhage and things like that. So here you've done, so after all these years of research, paracetamol, not much good. In fact, I don't think it was any good. Opioids, codeine-like drugs, a bit like the anti-inflammatories. You got some effect, but probably not enough to make a difference. And worthy of the constipation or the risk of addiction. And here you've done the same thing with non-steroidals. As a sufferer of back pain, like many people in Australia, I'm getting a bit depressed now, Manuela. Tell me something that I can do.
Okay.
And why painkillers aren't helping?
Well, there are many reasons why painkillers wouldn't help. So, for example, let's look at anti-inflammatories. So, the role of anti-inflammatory is to reduce inflammation. So, one reason could be that they are not reducing inflammation enough to actually result in a reduction in pain and improvement in function. Or it could be that inflammation is not the main cause of back pain. It could also be, like you're saying, that patients don't perceive that as being worthwhile overall. So, for example, anti-inflammatories and opioids can give some quick relief. But, you know, along the way, overall, that relief is not really perceived as being an improvement or don't lead them to recover from their condition.
So have we misconceived what back pain is?
It's a good question. We have noticed in research that the approaches, the treatments that have a broader view. So, for example, the healthy lifestyle interventions, reducing your weight, healthy diet, being physically active. So, all those approaches, they actually have a better or a greater benefit in the management of back pain. So, yeah, maybe we have been looking at...
Just forgive me a moment of skepticism. Yeah. What's a healthy diet got to do with my back?
Well, healthy diet has a lot to do with your stress, has a lot to do with maintaining your healthy weight. So that has a lot to do with your back.
Now, physiotherapists have developed the evidence base around physiotherapy, chiropractic, I mean, it's kind of there. Your manipulation might help in the acute, but doesn't help in the long term. But there's been a recent thing about core muscle strengthening. I mean, is there any physio that actually helps here?
There is actually exercise-based or physical activity-based interventions that do help. So exercising, strengthening your core, or sometimes even going for a walk. So all of that has been shown to effectively reduce your back pain.
As opposed to just lying down to it.
Exactly. And yeah.
And you're also about to tell me you need more research to find out really what's going on.
We do. So
of course.
Yeah, we do.
Manuela, thanks. But you're a back pain sufferer yourself.
I am a back pain sufferer myself, yeah.
So physiotherapist, heal thyself.
You know, when I'm in crisis, what I personally do, I go for a short walk, a light walk. And that, for me, it does the trick.
But people get into sort of bad posture. You've got to really correct that too, because that can make you worse.
So one piece of advice is actually to stay away from prolonged sitting, prolonged standing, and stay away from activities or positions that actually aggravate your symptoms.
Manuela, thank you very much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Associate Professor Manuela Ferreira, who is at the George Institute in Sydney. Let's stay with international research coming out of Australia, because an international study led by Australians has found that asthma medication normally reserved for more severe asthma could benefit children and adults at what used to be thought of as at the mild end. Professor Helen Riddell of the Wilcock Institute led the study, and she's with us now. Welcome to the Health Report, Helen.
Thank you.
So just explain the thinking behind this study and what the before state was. In other words, what the policy was for asthma care before you did this study.
This study actually originated out of investigating the evidence behind guidelines about which patients should receive a preventer inhaler, an anti-inflammatory inhaler for asthma. We found that over the last 20 years, it's been consistently recommended that you don't need one until you have symptoms around about more than, say, two or three days a week. We went looking for the evidence for that and didn't find any in the published literature. And
you're
so,
kidding.
Yeah.
So this received wisdom is based on nothing.
Well, look, I think it links with the concept of asthma that was around when the guidelines were first written, that asthma was perceived as a condition of narrowing of the airways that was readily relieved by short-acting blue puffer, such as Ventolin. Since then, it's been very well established that asthma is generally characterised by inflammation, but it seemed as if no one had gone back and actually looked at the implications of that for who should get treatment.
So you'd been involved in this large study called START. You'd better tell us about that before you...
Yeah, so we were particularly interested in mild asthma because that was where the evidence gap was. And after quite a bit of investigation, we found this particular study.
Because people might get a bit lost. So the policy for mild asthma, and we're talking about both children and adults here, but is that, if you're only going to get wheezing once a week or something like that, then the blue puffer's fine. Just take it before you go out on a cold day or before you have exercise. But if you're starting to use it a lot, then you might need a preventer. That was the sort of advice.
That's right, yes. So we looked for studies that had recruited people who had mild symptoms, infrequent symptoms like that, and found this large study that had been published in 2003 in over 7,000 patients with mild asthma, children and adults, in which they'd been randomised to receive either a very low dose of a preventer inhaler or a placebo. What we looked at was whether the frequency of the patient's symptoms at baseline predicted whether they responded to the preventer inhaler. So we were testing the basis for this previous assumption about who should get them.
And this required a reanalysis of the data.
That's right, yes.
So just before we go on, I don't want to get too technical here, and we've had stories on this before on the Health Report, is that when it's kind of a no-go area, reanalyzing data in a trial, isn't it? Because you're trying to find out something that a trial wasn't designed to discover.
That's a good point. In this case, the initiative for doing this analysis came from investigators like myself. I was involved in updating international asthma guidelines, so it wasn't driven by the company. And we set down our question in advance and did an analysis plan in advance. So it was done with the same level of rigour as if that had been the original question. Now, obviously, that isn't as strong as conducting a study like this from the start, but it would be hugely expensive and take a very long time to start a process like that from now.
So what did you find?
What we found was that regardless of how frequent the patients had symptoms at baseline, whether it was less than once a week or more than 2 days a week, they got a similar benefit from this low-dose preventer. It halved their risk of having a severe flare-up that would take them to the emergency department or in hospital. It reduced the decline in their lung function and it improved their symptoms, which were already fairly infrequent in that group. So we found that there was benefit across the board for people with mild asthma.
And what sort of numbers did you have to, because it's fine to say that, but somebody at the more severe end is going to get a severe exacerbation of their asthma more frequently than somebody at the mild end, aren't they? And therefore, they're going to get a higher percentage benefit from taking the preventer, or have I misread your results?
Well, what we found was that the risk was halved, regardless of what the
But if your risk is low, you've
right.
halved it from a low risk.
Exactly.
So it's a half of small number. It still makes you wonder, I mean, how many children would have to take the puffer for one asthma event to be prevented?
Exactly. And that's where the debate is at the present, because what this would require would be taking a regular preventer every day when you perhaps only have symptoms, say, once a week or less. So that's the really interesting thing about this research. It leads us to say, is there something better than this that can be used in the future to give protection but without having to take a daily preventer inhaler?
Such as?
Well, at the moment, so there have been various options have been tested, but the one we're investigating at the moment in several large studies is to look at a combination inhaler that gives you quick relief, but it also contains an anti-inflammatory medication. Looking at that taken as needed.
But they already exist.
That's right. They're only approved at the moment for people who have more persistent asthma symptoms, who need a regular daily inhaler and who aren't well controlled with just a low-dose preventer alone. So they're there on the market. Safety has been well established. What we're testing is a new way of using these in people with very mild asthma who just use that combination preventer and reliever.
So instead of taking the blue puffer when you get your wheezing, you would take the combination and in theory get a bit more kick to it because you've got the preventer as well as the long-acting reliever.
That's right. And the key thing about this particular medication that we're testing, which has a combination of budesonide and formoterol in it, is that we already know from studies in people with more severe asthma that if you quickly increase the dose based on your symptoms as you start to get worse, it markedly reduces your risk of having a flare-up. So there's already a history with this particular medication to suggest that if you get extra anti-inflammatory treatment when your asthma symptoms are more, that you may get greater benefit. But this has to be tested, and we've got some large studies underway looking at that at the moment.
But research that you've been involved with in Sydney and also, you know, the thunderstorm asthma event in Melbourne has shown that there people, even if they're prescribed these preventers, aren't taking them.
Yes, that's right. So overall, in data from the whole of Australia, from the PBS data set, we see that fewer than 20% of young adults with asthma take enough of a preventer to be taking it regularly. And overall, probably most people take about 25% of the prescribed dose. Now, that's clearly far from desirable if this is something that is going to substantially reduce your risk of an adverse outcome in the future.
And very briefly, we're almost out of time. People say that asthma is a different disease in children. Did you get different results in children from adults in this study?
This study included children from the age of 6 upwards, and we didn't see a difference by age group in the reanalysis.
Helen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Professor Helen Riddell of the Woolcock Institute. You've been listening to The Health Report. I'm Norman Swan. I hope you can join me next week.